are sponsored this week by the Republican Main Street Partnership. We welcome them. Main Street members are the governing wing of the Republican Party. They are the majority makers who represent swing states from coast to coast in Congress, and they're committed to achieving real results for the American people. In this November, control of the U.S. House of Representatives will decide these swing districts held by Main Street. It's very, very important. The whole shebang hinges on this thing. Main Street membership has grown to nearly 80 members represented from California all the way up to Maine, and they're getting things done, and they're committed to getting important work done. But this doesn't mean that they're men and women who are your typical Republicans. Main Street is dedicated to electing and defending legislators who will govern effectively in the Republican tradition, and they're willing to make the tough choices to get results for American families. To learn more about the mainstream members of Congress, you need to know that you got to support them, you got to help them out. Visit Main Street on the Hill, all one word, mainstreetonthehill.org. Now, return to regularly scheduled programming. So as we normally do on Fridays, we suck somebody out of their normal lives and into our miserable existence. And I am honored and thrilled to welcome this week's guest, Ken Starr, Judge Starr, so many different titles, special counsel. He's got a new book, Contempt, the memoir of the Clinton investigation. If you were alive in the 1990s, you've definitely heard of Judge Ken Starr. Judge, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jerry. Good to be here.
Before we get into any of the book, and I want to go into the book because this was my formative years in college, I want to talk to you about what's going on right now. Brett Kavanaugh worked for you during your special counsel days. You see what's happening now, and you see it's almost like a greatest hits. It's this old playbook. First of all, tell us a little bit about the man, Brett Kavanaugh, that you know. Is he capable of something like these allegations?
Well, I don't think so. I have complete confidence, Derek, in Brett's integrity. I should say Judge Kavanaugh, but I've known him since his first name was Brett and not Judge. And he is such a fine person. We see people rallying around him now, including 65 women who knew him in high school and said, this is not Brett. It is certainly not the Brett Kavanaugh who I've worked with since 1994. He has, quite apart from his abilities and his accomplishments, he has an absolutely perfect record in terms of treating people with kindness and decency and so forth. So this is so wildly out of character that it just seems to me to be odd in the extreme. I don't want to attack anyone, and I'm not going to attack anyone, including the accuser. I'm just not going to attack her. But this is not Brett Kavanaugh.
I should say this is Monday, and we'll air this on Friday, so who knows? They may have had a vote by now, but I just wanted to get that on record, because if you trace back, and it ties into the partisanship that came out of, I'd say it started with Judge Bork. It may have started before then. It certainly snowballed significantly during the Clinton administration.
Yes, it did.
And it's just gotten worse and worse and worse. So you were in on the very beginning. In the book, you weren't the original special counsel looking into it. Robert Fisk was. How did it come to you? You'd been a judge, you'd been then solicitor general, you'd been in all these different positions.
Right.
Who knocks on your door and says, hey, we're thinking about getting rid of Robert Fisk and replacing him with you, and why did you take that call?
Did you have to ask the second question? The short answer to the first is three judges. Under the old statute, which has gone away, a three-judge special panel of the D.C. Circuit, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, did the appointing. So when Whitewater first broke onto the national scene, and Bill Clinton, as president, said to Janet Reno, his attorney general, I'm directing you, he may have said it more politely than that, I'm directing you to appoint a special counsel, we would now say. She did, because there was no statute. So the traditional authority of the attorney general, which goes back to really the Judiciary Act of 1789, but it goes back most specifically to the administration of Ulysses S. Grant. For all these years, all these decades, when this kind of issue, wrongdoing by the president or wrongdoing just by very high officials in the government, through the Attorney General, has gone outside to bring in someone typically from the other political party.
Mm-hmm. So, Fisk was a moderate Republican.
Correct.
A conservative Republican. They Janet Reno, given her own choices, probably would not have had you in her Rolodex. So she might have somebody else. But yeah, the tradition meant.
No, and she chose very well. I mean, Robert Fisk was and is a great lawyer, great professional, total integrity. I admire what he has done, and frankly, I admired what I inherited when then those three judges knocked on my door, as you said, and said, Ken, we're not going to reappoint Bob Fisk. And they had reasons for that, having nothing to do with Bob Fisk, a man of great integrity, and had accomplished a lot. But he had been appointed by Janet Reno. And under the statute, the special counsel
Bill Clinton
was to
signed
be,
the statute into existence again in 1994, was it?
Correct.
And that meant that removed it completely from the Justice
Department. That was the interpretation then of these three judges. We need to now go to someone who has not been tainted, so to speak, by being appointed by
Janet
Reno.
Even though Fisk was a Republican.
Correct.
It was their Republican. We need to be fully independent.
Right.
The appearance of impropriety. Now, when you signed up for this, it was Whitewater. It was a land deal gone bad. There may have been some shady dealings with some money. And
there were. As I recount in the book, there were not just shady dealings, but there were shady dealings involving the Clintons.
But when you're going in, though, that's what you're thinking. You're just, this is a real estate deal. I'll look into it and find out whether or not they cooked the books or what have you. You stayed with your law firm part-time, which was allowed under the statute. You didn't think this was going to be all-consuming at all. How prepared were you for what it became?
Not well prepared. As I describe in the book, that very first day on the job, I took the oath of office at the courthouse. I had hail a cab. There was no Uber. I hail a cab.
No cell phone.
No cell phones, exactly. You know, the old fashioned, hey, cabbie. Then headed to what's now Reagan National Airport and fly to Memphis, change planes. In the meantime, and I've described this in the book, I have two conversations. One with Janet Reno, which was a pretty formal, kind of cold conversation, and the other with the counsel to the president, Lloyd Cutler. Mm-hmm. And that was it's a great insight into our system. That is, he said, Ken, I'm counsel to the presidency. David Kendall, the private lawyer at Williams & Connolly, is the counsel to the president. And that stayed with me, knowing that the counsel to the president should be above the fray,
right,
and not be part of the defense team. But anyway, so I get to Little Rock that same day, and I go in, I'm with Bob Fisk, and I tell the story in the book that toward the end of that day, Bob Fisk says, Ken, I knew Bob, move your family to Little Rock. You're going to be here for a long time. He'd been on the job for 8 months, but he was already looking into much more than a failed land deal in Arkansas. Right. And here's a key point that I think people, and in fact, I had a radio interview. The guy says there was nothing there. And I said, no, there was a lot there in Arkansas, 14 criminal convictions, including the sitting governor of the state. But there was a lot of evidence implicating Bill and Hillary. We just couldn't prove it beyyond a reasonable doubt.
How much of it was that roadblock or that inability to prove that it was the Clintons were directly involved, that it had to do with Susan McDougal's refusal to testify and willingness to sit in court? Jim McDougal was willing to, but he passed away.
Exactly. Jim McDougal, as to use the president's vernacular, flipped. So he had been convicted and was facing jail time. And so he began cooperating with the investigation just the way Paul Manafort is presumably doing at this time. And so it was a great breakthrough because Jim had been the head of the bank that failed, the Madison Guarantee Savings and Loan. But Susan was a business person. She was a marketing person, but she was also a business person. And so she had a lot of information. So you're exactly right. After he completes his work with us, and this is even in his book posted posthumously, Bill Clinton committed perjury at his trial, at the Jim Guy Tucker, Susan McDougal trial. All this I now recount in the book, but this was kind of shielded, but it just wasn't in the public eye. It never registered.
Newspapers, three broadcast networks, and one cable network. If they ignored it, it didn't go anywhere. The world didn't know about it. There was no internet to get things out.
We're in a much different place. You know, there's some bad things, obviously, about it. We see that every day. But the good news is there are more platforms for truth-seeking. You know, it was Matt Drudge. That was about it in those days. And, you know, who's Matt Drudge? What is this? But people developing stories, developing their own resources and so forth.
And ultimately forcing the rest of the media to cover it.
Yeah. That was the Lewinsky phase. I mean, Matt Drudge, I've never met Matt Drudge, but I don't think he was in business at the time. If he was, he did not have a national reputation. I do want to say this, since we're on the media, and not infrequently, my friends on the right say the media is horrible, the media is horrible. Much of the media was not. I divided the media into two camps, truth seekers and then everybody else.
One party was more crowded than the other party.
There's no question. But the truth seekers had some very great people from the mainstream media, including a real unsung hero, Sue Schmidt of the Washington Post, who the Clinton White House came out viciously. And to their credit, the Washington Post of Katherine Graham stood by her through thick and through thin. Lisa Myers, these are old names in the past, of NBC News.
Or Stuart Taylor, who's a Stuart Taylor was a
he was a truth seeker. And Lisa broke the story of Juanita Broderick, who claimed with some credibility that she had been raped by Attorney General Bill Clinton. So Jeff Gerth of the New York Times originally broke the Whitewater story during the campaign, but the issue did not develop legs during the 92 campaign. It came back up after the death of Vincent Foster Jr.
I want to get to Vince Foster's suicide in a second, but on the Whitewater front, how much of it do you think the lack of public interest in that was because it was regulatory, it was paperwork, it was minutiae, it wasn't as easily understandable as some of the other things. Because that seemed like there were major laws broken, they knew what they were doing, and they profited from it. It's a pretty easy case to make, except you have to go so far into the weeds to make it that the average person getting 3 minutes on their nightly news, their eyes glaze over and they move on.
And you're exactly right. And part of the challenge that we had in terms of public understanding was all this was laid out in a 3-month trial. Mm-hmm. So 3 months, what's the attention span?
We only pay attention to OJ for that long. That's it. But I just found it amazing because that was one of the Clintons, and we saw that later with the Lewinsky thing, but the Clintons were very good at delay, and then, it's old news at that point. And you get people, you have the interest at the beginning.
Right.
They wait out the interest. They manage to drag their feet past the interests of the people. Then they admit it and say it's old news.
Yep.
You were on the receiving end of that many times.
It was a diabolical but brilliant strategy, straight out of the pages of Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals. And one of the things that I want to remind the American people of is that Hillary Clinton, as a student at Wellesley, embraced Rules for Radicals. Now, not Rules for Thoughtful Liberals, Rules for Radicals, and it is destroy. And we see those techniques throughout the Clinton White House, including by Bill himself, who I think was a friendly enough guy that I don't think he was being animated by Rules for Radicals, but she was.
I think Bill kind of, he could work across the aisle. He could get along, go along. He had certain lines politically, but no. Hillary, not so much.
Oh, my goodness. No, the night and day, I mean, you saw this. And I realized she was a little bit of a fish out of water in Arkansas, but we're really talking about personality. Mm. Someone from Chicago, Illinois, can do just fine in Little Rock, but she was the fish out of water. And, you know, this was Bill. But we see Bill, people like Bill Clinton to this day.
Yes.
If he were in here, you would like him.
And he'd probably act like he liked us, too.
Oh, there's no question. In fact,
have you ever met him?
Oh, yeah, because of all the investigation, but no.
But not casually, not accidentally.
No.
That we'll get to in a second. But
yeah. Okay. Well, I do describe one incident when, at the Hyatt Regency Hotel, when he was a newly elected governor, I was in the same elevator with him. And he was holding forth in the elevator. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't talk to him or whatever because it was a crowded elevator, some kind of convention was going on. But go ahead.
The investigation evolves. Vince Foster commits suicide. Now, Vince Foster seems like a guy who had everything going for him.
Absolutely.
And who knows why anybody does that. But in the midst of Vince Foster's suicide, all these conspiracy theories. The documents being removed. Was Vince Foster murdered? Then you end up with Hillary Clinton having the Rose Law Firm billing records that had been under subpoena for some time in the private residence of the White House. Probably one of the most secure areas on the face of the earth. You said you almost charged her with perjury in part because of that.
As well as obstruction.
Was it simply because, as you recounted when you were talking about the near perjury and obstruction charges, she said, I don't remember more than 100 times in the course of a couple of hours. Unless she'd recently suffered a closed head injury, I don't know how that's possible. But did you ever get the sense, do you think you could have made that case? Do you think is there a way to make that case, especially now looking back?
No, given the evidence that we had, and more importantly, the evidence that we didn't have. So that was a circumstantial case,
Was there ever a plausible explanation to explain why those papers ended up in the White House residency?
There was a plausible explanation, but not an innocent explanation. The explanation was, and this is my theory, I lay this out in the book, I think this is one of the reasons, it's an opinion, but it's an opinion based upon thinking really hard about, here are the facts. Why did Vince Foster take his own life? The conspiracy theorists, with all due respect, are just wrong. Mm-hmm. So any person who reads our report, primarily authored by Brett Kavanaugh, will come to the view that unless they think, well, he's just making this up. No, no, no. Grounded in fact. So he took his own life, but why? And my theory is Vince Foster either directly or ordered the removal of the Rose Law Firm billing records because they implicated Hillary in providing legal services for Madison Guarantee Savings and Loan. And his own handwriting was on those billing records with some notations and so forth. Those are the records then, and he becomes Deputy White House Counsel with an office in the West Wing. Those are the records then that my theory is they were removed from his office improperly and taken to the residence where they were found in the book room.
Originally, Hillary said she didn't do anything or very little work when she was working for the Rose Law Firm on Madison Guarantee. Those records that were found show that she did quite a bit.
Yes, but the Clintons were so effective that the news coming out of the Clinton count, thank goodness they've been found. They corroborate exactly what Hillary has been saying, which was just wrong.
Thank goodness you found what we've been hiding from you, finally. Yeah. And then one day, I don't know, how does Linda Tripp come into, how does the whole Monica Lewinsky thing, did Linda Tripp contact you?
Exactly. So that story briefly told, I tell it in greater detail and contempt. So Linda Tripp was the executive assistant to Vince Foster. She was the last person in the White House complex that we know of to see him alive. So she was a witness who we had worked with in trying to get to the bottom of the death of Vincent Foster Jr. So then the years go by and the phone rings, and on a Sunday night, I go into detail on this, she talks to my deputy, Jackie Bennett, a terrific prosecutor, won the most heralded and high achievement award in the Department of Justice. So this career prosecutor from the public integrity section feels the call, and that's when we learned about the president's attempt, or his soon attempt, and his success at committing perjury and encouraging others to commit perjury.
That, you had to go back to the judges to get permission to go into this, did you not?
The attorney general did. See, here's the, that's another thing that gets lost in the Monica Lewinsky fog. So the information comes to us. We have the verification by virtue of our recording the conversation that's a real time between Monica's. We're not just listening to tapes. Mm. We've confirmed this at the Ritz-Carlton in Pentagon City. And so we take that information to the Attorney General, and she determines, she sent over a very senior Justice Department prosecutor, terrific guy. I knew him. Very strong reputation, integrity, career civil servant, and he reviews the evidence. He goes back to the Justice Department. She very promptly decides our mandate in the independent counsel's office has to be expanded to include an investigation into whether Monica Lewinsky and others have committed perjury or other offenses in connection with the Paula Corbin Jones sexual harassment lawsuit.
Now, that's a giant bear trap and a sidewalk on a sunny day. Did you know you were going to step in that in the storm that would follow it, or did you?
You don't know, Derek, but you sense, you know, I'm trying to get away to Pepperdine University to become the dean of the law school. So I need this like the proverbial hole in the head. But our focus was, here it is. We can't ignore it. Here is the President of the United States involved in criminal conduct. We were already of the view that it had been in the criminal conduct in Arkansas, and we couldn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. I want everyone to understand, when we tried to be prosecutors of integrity, you don't bring charges in the federal system unless you have concluded that you can prove the offense by admissible evidence, so where are your witnesses, where are your documents, beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's a great protection to the American people.
But I knew you had to know that you were going to catch hell. That you'd already dealt with Clinton pushback on Whitewater and Vince Foster and the other investigations. But this was going to a new level.
Yes.
Were you? Is there any way that you... You knew something was coming, but did you know what it was? Because you had all the dogs of hell from the administration. He used his cabinet officials to go out and lie. James Carville unleashed, accusing you of being a pervert and just a sex obsessed. I mean, I don't know how you could prepare for that. What was that like, and how did your family deal with that?
Ironically, we were somewhat prepared. I analogize it. I love baseball. To being in the minor leagues, that is, we were attacked and vilified in Arkansas, or I should say, I was attacked most directly. The governor of the state had been indicted. So what's the governor and his apparatus? I mean, he had a PR firm and all that, and lawyers going out on the courthouse steps. So the theme we were hearing in Little Rock, Arkansas, it's a Republican politicized investigation. All they're trying to do is to bring down the Clintons. Mm. So we'd already heard that. So I guess we had developed one layer of skin to get a little bit more thick skin. But no, I had not anticipated, and I don't think I could reasonably have anticipated the furor and the fury with which the president saw fit to wage war.
A lot of positions changed then. When Monica was first added, her attorney was critical of President Clinton at the time, and you thought, oh, maybe she's going to cooperate. What happened there? Why didn't she cooperate as much as she could have?
My theory, and only Monica can answer this, and I don't think she has. She blames me.
Right.
I made her life miserable, and I understand that perspective. I disagree with it, but that's her perspective. I think she was bound and determined to protect the president.
You think it was still, she was in love with him still at
that
time?
There's no question. Well, I can't say she was in love, but she did not want to bring with us a mixture of admiration, affection, and political affinity. She said this, I described this, this has not previously been described. I describe it in the book. Her hallway conversation with her mother at the Ritz-Carlton, I'm not, she used very foul language to make it very clear to her mom that she was not going to bring this president down. So I think she viewed the situation in apocalyptic terms, and she wanted to help save the president.
Are you surprised how well the Clintons landed on their feet after all the... You know more about their dirty dealings than probably anybody except for people they were involved with. Now, right after 2000, she gets elected to the Senate. She's a front runner for the presidential nomination in 2008. Bill Clinton becomes sort of an elder statesman. All is sort of forgotten and swept under the rug. Are you surprised how quickly that happened?
No, I think the American people, first of all, were very forgiving. In fact, one of the things...
Only when asked for it. We weren't asked.
No, it's a good point, but part of it, I think, really goes to Bill Clinton's personal qualities of being likable. It's very hard, I think, to overestimate the importance in politics, public life, of being likable. It's part of my free advice.
Someday I'll figure that out, but it's never been an issue for me.
You're doing great, Derek. But
I'm holding it in.
It's one of the things that I know we live in a very polarized time that, and he hasn't asked me, but I tell him anyway, President Trump, be a little bit more likable. Quit picking so many dadgum fights. You don't need to do this. And I think he gets that advice probably every day, and he shuts it aside. So maybe he's right. But that's Bill's. If Bill, this was a great story about Bill Clinton, that if he goes into a crowded room and everybody's his friend and supporter, but he sees three non-friends over in a corner, he heads to them. He has great confidence in his ability to win people over, which I think is what doomed him in when it came to the rule of law and telling the truth. I think he had so much confidence in his communication skills, and they are great, they are legendary, yes, that he could, in fact, get away with perjury and obstruction of justice.
Let me ask you about the attacks on you. Did any of them sting? You couldn't really come out and refute them, rebut them, answer them. You couldn't get into an argument with the President of the United States or any of his flying monkey army or anything like that. But being hammered and forced to be silent had to be a massive weight.
I was doing everything I could through the pillars of faith, family, and friends to stay strong because I had the servant leadership responsibility for my colleagues to try to be an example of them to gut it out. But there's a poignant moment that I capture in the book about our very dear friend, our pastor at our church in Northern Virginia at the time, gives a sermon about the loss of reputation. It wasn't directed at me, but as he was speaking, I was thinking, you know, Vince Foster gave this very poignant speech just 2 months before he took his life, a commencement speech at his alma mater in Fayetteville, saying, don't lose your reputation. It's the most precious thing. And then he took his life. So I'm thinking Vince Foster and, yeah, loss of reputation. And then I'm saying goodbye to Lon, our pastor, at the end. He said, Ken, I was talking about you. I thought, oh, great, loss of reputation. So that was a downer moment, but I tried to, it's just the way I am, I try to walk on the sunny side of the street and to just stay focused, try to, and I wouldn't come home. Geraldo is now a different Geraldo, but mm-hmm. then Geraldo was one of the echo chambers. Anything the Clinton folks wanted, Geraldo would, and he was really pretty nasty. And people say, did you see what Geraldo did? And my answer was, no, and I don't want to. But I knew things had gotten bad when someone came in, I recount this in contempt. Hey, Ken, and I had an open door policy, maybe I shouldn't have, especially in this particular episode. Ken, guess what? The polls are out. Your numbers are below those of Saddam Hussein. So I knew the Clinton spin cycle and machine was really powerful and very effective.
If you had it to do over again, would you do it?
Yeah,
putting aside the pursuit of justice.
Yeah.
Knowing everything you went through.
Yes, I would do it because I was asked to do it, and I've never turned down an assignment. And by the way, I should say, I was very privileged and blessed to have some assignments I didn't deserve. So it was time that I took a hell of a penance. Yeah, okay, good. I've done my penance. I hope higher authority hears that. But I would be a lot smarter now, needless to say. Having been through all this, I would have hired a press person much earlier. Mm. I resisted doing that. That was not a wise move.
You weren't a prosecutor. You weren't in the business of PR. You were going where the facts made you, and you didn't. Was that a sign of you just didn't really realize what you were up against? That you were resistant to a press.
It was a conception of the job, and the desire to do the job as quickly, as efficiently, and frankly, as inexpensively as possible. So I resisted add-ons and so forth. I drove around a GSA car. I had a very simple apartment in Little Rock that I lived in.
So at the end of the day, you didn't really answer. Geraldo said some things that stuck. But is there anything, did you lose friends over this? Did you lose?
No, there were some nasty episodes, but not in Little Rock, interestingly enough. I never had a nasty episode in Little Rock. No, I would say if anything, friends rallied around. The people at our children's school, and I talk a lot about the personal level, but frankly, the toughest thing was to have my daughter at Stanford University under round-the-clock security, because she was under death threat, because Chelsea was there. So there was kind of the dark side.
Did they ever run into each other?
They never did. Interestingly, she was a sophomore. She had a very different major. It's a big university. And I don't think the Secret Service and Carolyn were the U.S. Marshals. I don't think they were trying to keep them separated.
Right.
But Carolyn was in a sorority. She was very involved in a cappella group. She was very involved in a church group in East Palo Alto and so forth. They just weren't running in the same crowd. But Carolyn was not in Young Republicans or what have you.
Right.
I mean, she had, after that first year, a great college life at Stanford. And I think Chelsea had a great experience at Stanford.
She seems to be happy. You might be the person, I was just thinking about this, you might be the person I've seen take out their trash more than anybody who doesn't live adjacent to me. Every day, was it that you went out to get into your car, were there camera crews there?
Yes.
They could get the gist of it in like 2 days. There he is in two different color suits.
No.
We've got this. We'll just alternate them. But they were there every day.
Well, I talked to the media folks about this. I mean, the people who were there were really good folks, right? They were not that. Only one time did I have
the camera people are really the salt of the earth.
They're just good folks doing their job. I only had one time in that whole episode where a reporter was there just yelling almost epithets, right? She was part of the resistance, I guess. Probably is very active in the resistance now. But I had a treaty of peace with the media, which is, in those days, the marshals let me go to Starbucks. It was I'm a big Starbucks. I love Pete's. I love all kinds of
coffee. Because it's got your name.
You know?
Starbucks.
That's it. So, in any event, I would have a treaty in place that at about 6:15, I would hop into my own car, you know, in sweats or whatever, go grab Starbucks for Alice and me, and, you know, they wouldn't film it, right? That was the agreement.
I want to see Ken Starr in his sweats hopping
sure,
into the car.
Sure, I'm in sweats all the time. I was in sweats
never early, seen that. I was
earlier
seen
today. But they were honorable. They didn't film. But then I would say departure at 7:10, 7:15, and I would stick with that just so they could know. I mean, you need to have predictability. So you could get your camera. And I would say, well, I'm not really going to say anything other than the investigation is ongoing. Have a nice day and so forth. I said, we need fresh material every day.
Every day.
Yeah, every day.
So every day. I remember just every single day. And it was a banner day, the one day, garbage week.
Yeah.
Garbage day, because you take out your garbage.
Derek, I did learn I had to stop doing that. We would take the garbage out after the media had gone.
They were tempted, I don't know, I would have worn something crazy or some weird hat or something just to break it up.
You got a better sense of humor than I do. I'm a lawyer.
I don't have the responsibilities that you had, so I have the luxury of that. You did run into Monica Lewinsky around the holidays in New York.
Right.
And you spoke to her briefly. She wrote about it in New York Magazine or Fanfare or whatever. She still, to this day, blames you, thinks you were the problem, not the people involved in it, the person who helped discover it. And I assume she hates Linda Tripp as well. But what was going through your mind when you see Monica Lewinsky in a restaurant?
I felt the need to go say hello.
Do you feel guilt or anything towards what happened to her?
No, I feel badly
for
her.
Distinct difference.
Just as a
two.
Human being, but no. In fact, I'm now asked, as I'm talking about the book, don't you think you need to apologize? And sometimes it's put in those kind of attack terms. And I said, no, I don't. I feel badly for what happened. Do you regret? Of course, I regret the pain that was caused the country. But it really boils down to individuals living up to their responsibility to be truthful citizens and not to lie under oath, which Monica did. And then she was encouraging Linda Tripp to lie under oath. But what Monica said, and I recount this toward the end of the book, was I made some bad choices, and I'm sort of regretting those bad choices, and I regret the bad the choices you made as well. And I didn't respond. I just listened to her, and I said, I wish you well. To be honest, what was on my mind was, we're going to be late for church because it's Christmas Eve. So I was trying to get children and grandchildren out of the restaurant.
Last thing, why'd you wait 20 years?
I've been busy, fully
it's
occupied.
No excuse.
Yeah, no excuses.
So you actually wrote it, no ghostwriter.
No ghostwriter. And
but it's been 20.
It's been 20.
But that's part of it. Did you need the perspective?
It was helpful to have the perspective because essentially the pain, the anger, and so forth was totally gone. But also Hillary had lost the election. So it was now
the
end of the...
Is this book published if she wins in 2016?
I think that would have been a harder question for me. Do I really want to... I want our president to succeed. Mm-hmm. I may not have voted for our president, but I would not like the idea of raining on the parade. But I had the time, flexibility, freedom to do it now. And so I knew that I would not be raining on the president's parade had she won.
And what do you want people to know, to take away? What the last nugget as they go to bed, as they close this for the last time, as they sink to sleep, what do you want going through their head?
Well, I want them to sleep well, but I want it to go that our system works, the rule of law is real, we're going to hold everyone accountable. This is not Russia, this is not a third world country, and now, very relevantly, impeachment is hell. Don't go there.
Amen. Contempt, a memoir of the Clinton administration. Ken Starr, he's going to sign these for us. If you want to win a copy, email Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com. Mention any bribes you got. I'm open to it. Otherwise, it'll just be a random drawing. One of these will be for me. That's just how I roll. But thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Derek.
I appreciate it. Go get the book. It's available now. It's selling gangbusters. We'll see you Monday.